This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Observatory straight up the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
They didn't break that, but they have pretty good access to those people.
Yeah, subconsciously mocks that lineage, but
so that's happening.
It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In the past week, an avalanche of stories about Donald Trump's zero-tolerance policy at the border and its appalling consequences for the children taken from their parents finally caused the president to modify that policy with an executive order. Among the reporters doing that critical work was the New Yorker's Jonathan Blitzer, who's been reporting in El Paso, Texas.
I am in a parking lot across the street from the ICE processing center. I'm just standing outside in the heat outside my car.
John had just walked out of an ICE facility. He wasn't allowed to call from inside, but he had gotten permission to interview a woman named Ana Maritza Rivera, who was being held there.
She is being processed to be deported. She's in the deportation process, and it's now just a matter of days before she is put on a plane and flown home to Honduras. And so she's waiting to see if she can get reunited with her 5-year-old son.
Trump's executive order on Wednesday stopped the forcible separation of children, but it did nothing to address the more than 2,000 children who are already in federal detention. Rivera's son, Jairo, is just one of them.
So Amritz and her son crossed the U.S.-Mexico border, or attempted to cross the U.S.-Mexico border on midnight on May 5th. She was a part of a big group of Hondurans who were attempting the trip from Ciudad Juarez. They attempted to go under one of the international bridges and then from there sort of scurry over a bit of wire fencing. And they did not get far before they were surrounded by Border Patrol agents and all of them arrested. And the Border Patrol agents then took them to El Paso to begin their criminal charging and their deportation process. And so Ana Maritza described being in a pretty big cell with about 25 other women and their children. The men from the group were in a separate cell with the kids that they came with. And the first night she's with her kid. And she's kind of waiting to see what happens. And then the second day in the afternoon, two Border Patrol agents enter the cell. And these two agents just start to try to remove her son, her 5-year-old son, from her. And she starts to scream and cry and claw at them. Her kid, she describes specifically the feeling of her kid's arms kind of clinging to her and pulling at her. And the two Border Patrol agents managed to wrest him from her. She resisted. She was extremely upset, crying, yelling, asking what was going on. I asked her if the other women in the cell were shouting or trying to do something. I think all of them were just so shocked. And what she explained to me was that her son was the first from this group to be taken from a mother. And so I think in some ways what may have happened was that they didn't even really understand, Ana Maritza nor any of the other women really understood what was going on. And that was mostly what she described. It wasn't her grief sort of manifested itself in an odd way. It wasn't it wasn't as kind of stormy and obvious as you'd expect. It was just, she just seemed dazed. She almost seemed out of it as she tried to describe what this stuff was. And I think she was very confused in the moment about what was happening. And then sure enough, it became clear to her over the next few days that, that she and her son were going different ways, because from then on, they took her to in front of a judge to charge her with the illegal entry. And from there, she was transferred to U.S. Marshal custody. From there, she was eventually transferred back to immigration detention. And it was about 2 weeks before she even learned where her son was. And the way she found out wasn't because anyone took her aside and explained to her what was going on, but it was because she was now back in immigration detention. And she was just kept entirely to herself, was crying, wasn't eating. And another woman, a Guatemalan woman who had a 1.5-year-old son who had also been separated from her, recognized that Ana Maritza was in distress, walked up to her and said, "You should try calling this number. I couldn't find my kid. And this number is for a case manager who was in charge of my kid while we were separated." And all the number is, it's the name of a woman, and it's a phone number in the U.S., corresponds to Chicago. And Ana Maritza, at the time, didn't have money on a phone card to call from inside the ICE detention center. So this woman let her use her phone card. And just through sheer good luck, when Ana Maritza called this number, the person who answered in Chicago, case manager at a facility run by the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is in charge of handling these kids who've been separated from their parents, picks up and is thrilled to hear that it's Ana Maritza, because this woman, in fact, was at a loss as to what to do because they couldn't figure out who this child's mother was. And then this past weekend, Ana Maritza learned that her son had been transferred to a facility just outside of El Paso. And so that seems to bode well in that at least he's closer. She still can't see him. She now has a number for another case manager who deals with her son every day. And she said to me at one point, you know, she said, I can't, he's, when he talks on the phone, he sounds sad. He begs me to come pick him up. He says, Mom, take me home. I want to go home. I don't like this. And all she can say is, be patient. We're almost there.
Up until last week, even as outrage was growing, zero tolerance was being defended by the administration as merely a matter of law enforcement.
The argument the government gave was these people are entering the country illegally because they're not entering the country through an official port of entry where Customs and Border Protection have kind of a hub. And that's a pretty dubious claim to start with, because people who are seeking asylum don't only have to go through a port of entry to seek asylum. They can cross the border and say, I'd like asylum, and they should be given a chance to make their case. But the argument made by the administration and by Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, was that amounts to a loophole that has to be closed. People are gaming the system. We have to arrest anyone who crosses the border illegally. And so there's this immediate moment of rupture when a parent and a kid cross together under zero tolerance. The parent goes first into the custody of U.S. Marshal and eventually appears before a judge. The judge charges the parent. That parent then goes back to the custody of the Department of Homeland Security, immigration, detention. The parent's child, in the meantime, goes down an entirely different route. The parent's child goes into the care of the Department of Health and Human Services, and more specifically, an office inside the Department of Health and Human Services called the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Typically, the Office of Refugee Resettlement handles child migrants who come to the U.S. seeking asylum alone without their parent. And so the entire legal process for handling that child is entirely independent of the legal process that takes place for the parent. And there is no alignment between the two. And so that's how you're getting parents in immigration detention who don't know where their child is. They then have to, through their own force of will and through the aid of advocates and lawyers, start to piece together where their child is. And this was formally announced last month. But the actual policy itself dates to the summer of 2017. And it's been going on since then in more limited fashion along different patches of the border. And it's hard to know the full scope of it. The only numbers we have are from the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security says that it's been over 2,000 cases over the last 2 months. And yet at the same time, the head of the Department of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, has also said that there is no policy for separating families. So it doesn't leave you with much confidence that the government's numbers are accurate or representative.
As John and many other reporters have found, the bureaucratic chaos has left people like Anna Maritza with essentially no help at all from the government to navigate the system and find their children.
At a certain point in our conversation, she stopped and she looked at me and she said, "This isn't going to hurt my case, is it?" And typically when I'm asked that by someone in some state of immigration detention, it's because they don't want something from an interview to come out and hurt their case for staying in the U.S. Anna Maritza's concern was exactly the opposite. She said to me, I want to be deported as soon as possible. She really thinks that the faster she can get out of here, the sooner she can be with her son. The hardest part for us, I think, the hardest part for me in this conversation is what she said. She said, "I told this ICE official that if I get to the airport and my son is not there, you'll be killing me." And that's as far as she seemed even able to contemplate the prospect. She then said, "I will not board that plane. I will not get on that plane. I will not go anywhere if my son is not there." It was a very difficult conversation to have.
Jonathan Blitzer, speaking last week from outside an immigration detention facility in El Paso. We'll update you on Ana Maritza Rivera and her son when we learn more. You can find John's reporting from Texas at newyorker.com. Now in Mexico, policies like child separation at the border have fueled a surge of anti-U.S. sentiment that may change the course of politics and history in that country. On our podcast, Politics and More, John Lee Anderson talks about the upstart leftist candidate who is likely to take the reins from Mexico's ruling party, the PRI. That's Politics and More from The New Yorker. You're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
So much jargon here. I need to explain to you.
Exactly.
I'm gonna slow down.
I'm David Remnick, and you're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So the puzzles progress in difficulty.
If you're a crossword nut, you might recognize the names Anna Schechtman and Cameron Austin Collins. They are puzzle constructors who have contributed to the New York Times.
I can get through Monday, and then by Tuesday, I decide through pure sanctimony that this is a worthless pursuit.
Yeah.
Simply because it's beating me into
the ground. You turn on the puzzle. That's what you do.
Right,
now, Cameron
and
Anna are part of a team of five people doing puzzles for The New Yorker. We just started publishing a weekly crossword a few months ago, and I wanted to figure out how they even begin to build a puzzle.
I start by consulting a list of words called my seeds. Phrases or words that I just think are really interesting that I really want to see in a crossword puzzle. And let's say I want to use the word fashionista. I'm a very visual person in my grids. I just like grids that are aesthetically pleasing and unique. So I find a way to build something beautiful before I worry about any of the other words.
How do we collaborate on clue making? Let's do this.
Okay. I have examples.
Ah, look at this. Literally under your hat.
Yeah, I really had all to, because right. Clues are hard to remember, honestly. You've done the New Yorker puzzles, or you haven't. Like, this would be one
let's
from...
Let's just say tears were rolling down my cheeks at
all right.
a certain point.
This one I like because it gets at that sort of intersection of the material quality of language and the sort of social quality, right? So it's Grande Dame of Pop Music.
Grande Dame of Pop Music. How many letters? You're counting with your fingers now.
I think six.
You think six. Madonna or Grande Dame. Queen
yeah,
Bay.
No, but that...
No, but I love what you're thinking.
It's a great seed.
Yeah,
answer.
Absolutely.
The answer is Ariana.
Oh, okay.
Because Grande.
Yeah.
It's a visual play.
It.
That's a very good clue.
Got it.
That's a very good clue.
Wow. All right, let's make some. Can we do that?
Sure.
Let's.
I mean, we could clue for Queen Bay.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
That's a tough one. I don't know exactly how I'd start.
It's a proper noun, and it's a nickname.
The most proper.
Beyonce is famous enough that you could be clever.
In the clue, somehow, we'd have to make reference to the fact that it's a nickname. We couldn't,
right?
Because you wouldn't want someone to think that Beyonce was the answer, right? That would,
right.
Or, you know, Mrs. Carter. There's just a lot of different possibilities.
She's rarely referred to. Well, the new album.
In the new album.
New
there
album,
we go.
She's Mrs. Carter. There you go.
Look at this.
I know. He's as up as we are. This is...
Give
this
me
is...
a break. Give me a break. You guys are so... You know, it's just... it's ageist of you is what it is. It's
first
really
of all,
ageist
another
of you.
Great entry.
Ageist.
Yes.
Ageism.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mrs. Carter's handle. No, nobody would know Miss. That sounds like Dome's
well,
little
Well, here's
pills.
The thing. Queen Bey is a play on, I mean.
Beehive.
Beehive.
Right? Yeah.
So Hive should be in the clue.
Right. Oh, my God. You're looking at me like I'm going to come out of the
clue. Well, I'm curious to see where your mind goes. But it's basically, you look at the qualities of the word and you say, what are the things that are fairest? And like,
right,
this is a royal title.
Do an easy one first.
Okay. Well, this is one of my favorites because it's actually quite simple. So how would you clue the word joy?
How would I clue the word joy? Ode to. But that's a
Monday.
But that's a Monday clue.
Yeah,
that's a
perfect,
great Monday clue.
They
Monday
said
clue.
Unbelievably condescending.
No, but
that's a Monday clue. David.
That's a great
Go
Monday clue.
Go sit in the corner and have a cookie. That's a Monday clue.
Can I just interject briefly?
Yeah.
What is amazing about this conversation is that you're actually trying to create some sort of rubric of what is a good word.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's just an amazing project to me.
This is why we're the literary nerds.
It's like, what is the standard here?
And that is your, by the way, other work.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're an editor, you're a writer,
yes.
And you're a film critic.
We also both are...
We're somewhere in the realm of the PhD, and I'm in English. And
English and film and media studies. Yeah, we're both, we're doing, we're busy.
I see. And you're doing the puzzle for us.
Yeah.
Right.
instead of doing puzzles then to relax, you're doing them to heighten your workload.
You know why I'm doing it? I'm doing it because I was solving the New York Times crossword for a little while. It was mostly something that my mom did growing up, and I thought it was always too stodgy. But when I started doing them, this was in graduate school when I was craving something else to do, I just kept doing the puzzle and not seeing. I just felt there were a lot of missed opportunities for kinds of culture that could be in the puzzle. I want to see more bands that I like. I want to see more.
You want the puzzle to say something.
Yeah. I want to see more black people. I want to see black people who aren't Jay-Z or Nas, who are common in puzzles because of the letter combination.
Because of the Z.
Yeah.
Or an N-A-S. Yeah.
Consonants together.
Right.
So how have you accomplished that? Give me an example of puzzle clues that you've done that have I diversified the world in some small way, or said something political, or said something interesting that you had a little tinge of pride in.
Yeah. Well, my debut puzzle for the New York Times, I published Anita Hill. I was the first person to put her in the New York Times crossword, which is late.
That's very late because you're a young guy and Anita Hill's been around for a long time.
Yes, indeed. Gaberhood was something that I put in the puzzle. I put fan fiction in the puzzle.
I put Shtup in a puzzle.
Whoa, Shtup was in
Shtup, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'll help sorry. With
the pronunciation. This is one of the best problems. This is one of the best days of my crossword life.
So a Yiddishism this. For the sexual act, or one of them, is in one of your...
Yes, in the New York Times, yeah. Well, okay,
well,
so...
That's a proud moment of a kind.
Yeah.
Now, what identity are you trying to create for the New Yorker puzzle as opposed to all the puzzles that you've seen elsewhere?
I think the thing about the New Yorker puzzle is that the distance between when we make the puzzle and when the puzzle runs is very short. So that means you can be very up with things that are immediately happening in the culture.
So for us, it takes how long?
A month? A little over a month?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
That's nothing.
Although when it comes to usage, it might be. I mean, I remember one time when I was working at the Times, we had a submission that had amazeballs as the one across. And I remember thinking, God, I hope this isn't in common usage when this runs. I hope this is done. I hope we're not using amazeballs.
Amazeballs had a very brief vogue.
Yeah. But that's one of the hard but interesting things, is like to try to put your finger on the thing that's not going to go out of favor in a couple of years or even a year. Because also just you're kind of giving it that sort of cultural significance. I prefer to put things in there that are going to be around a little while.
What is the ultimate compliment that you can get for a puzzle that you do?
I think that any type of aha that you get in whatever form that it comes across to you is the most gratifying.
On the subway or in a coffee shop, there's truly nothing like seeing someone do your puzzle.
Well, they're getting in your brain with you. It's really creepy.
It's very strange to be on the subway and see someone on their
phone. So it's like seeing somebody reading your piece on the subway.
Yeah, but like wrestling with your piece, like trying to solve your piece.
It's participating like participating with your piece.
Yeah, like in a conversation with you that they don't realize that you're there watching them have with you.
Yeah,
it's very strange.
I mean, it's like as if there were, as if the comment section were actually gratifying, right? As opposed to
what it usually is.
Yeah.
Now, this is a crucial question.
Yes.
When you think of your people doing this, your solvers,
yes,
are they cheating like crazy? Do they have their phones out?
Okay, I feel strongly about this. It's not cheating, it's learning.
Oh,
I agree.
My God.
I agree.
I don't know.
That was the most millennial thing you've said.
For sure.
God.
No, I just really believe that that crosswords have been formative for me educationally. So why would I?
So what you're admitting on the air.
Oh, that I cheat?
Like crazy.
Yes.
Do you cheat?
I don't cheat, but I approve of cheating.
I'm trying to figure that answer out. Well, I thank you both for coming here and for doing the puzzle for The New Yorker. It's a proud addition, and I'm delighted to have you here.
Thank you so much, really.
This is fun.
That was Cameron Austin Collins and Anna Schechtman, two of the puzzle constructors who make crosswords for The New Yorker. You can find a new puzzle every Monday at newyorker.com. Don't say I didn't warn you, because I have not finished one yet. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for this week. I hope you'll join us next time. And until then, keep up with us on Twitter at New Yorker Radio.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.